and then our southern border is completely lined with nations hostile to us. Then he looked up. This is much worse than I had been led to expect, Sergei Nikolaevich, he concluded soberly. We know the Chinese covet what we have in the east. This new state threatens our southern oil fields in the Transcaucasus. I cannot defend this border. My God, defending against Hitler was child's play compared to this. Golovko was on the other side of the map table. He'd called Bondarenko for a reason. The senior leadership of his country's military was composed of holdovers from the earlier era, but these were finally dying off. And Gennady Yosefovich was one of the new breed, battle-tested in the misbegotten Afghan war, old enough to know what battle was. Perversely, this made him and his peers the superiors of those whom they would soon replace, and young enough that they didn't have the ideological baggage of the former generation either. Not a pessimist, but an optimist ready to learn from the West, where he'd just spent over a month with the various NATO armies, learning everything he could, especially, it would seem, from the Americans. But Bondarenko was looking down at the map in alarm. How long, the general asked. How long to establish this new state? Golovko shrugged. Who can say? 3 years, perhaps two at the worst. At best, five. Give me 5 years and the ability to rebuild our country's military power, and we can probably... No. Bondarenko shook his head. I can give you no guarantee. The government will not give me the money and resources I require. It can't. We do not have the money to spend. And then? The general looked up, straight into the RVS chairman's eyes. And then I would prefer to be the operations officer for the other side. In the east we have mountains to defend, and that is good. But we have only two rail lines for logistical support, and that is not so good. In the center, what if they absorb all of Kazakhstan? He tapped the map. Look how close that puts them to Moscow. And what about alliances? With Ukraine, perhaps? What about Turkey? What about Syria? All of the Middle East will have to come to terms with this new state. We lose, Comrade Chairman. We can threaten to use nuclear arms, but what real good does that do us? China can afford the loss of 500 million and still outnumber us. Their economy grows strong while ours continues to stagnate. They can afford to buy weapons from the West, or better yet, to license the designs to manufacture their own. Our use of nuclear arms is dangerous, both tactically and strategically, and there is the political dimension which I will leave to you. Militarily, we will be outnumbered in all relevant categories. The enemy will have superiority in terms of arms, manpower, and geographic location. Their ability to cut off the oil supply to the rest of the world limits our hope of securing foreign help, assuming that any Western nation will have such a desire in the first place. What you have shown me is the potential destruction of our country. That he delivered this assessment calmly was the most disturbing fact of all. Bondarenko was not an alarmist. He was merely stating objective fact. And to prevent it? We cannot permit the loss of the southern republics, but at the same time, how do we hold them? Take control of Turkmenistan? Fight the guerrilla campaign that would surely result? Our army is in no shape to fight that sort of war. Not even one of them. And it won't be just one, will it? Bondarenko's predecessor had been fired over the failure of the Red Army, the term and the thought died hard, to deal effectively with the Chechens. What should have been a relatively simple effort at pacification had advertised to the world that the Russian army was scarcely a shadow of what it had been only a few years before. The Soviet Union had operated on the principle of fear, they both knew. Fear of the KGB had kept the citizens in line, and fear of what the Red Army could and would do to any systematic rebellion had prevented large-scale political disturbances. But what happened when the fear went away? The Soviet failure to pacify Afghanistan, that, despite the most brutal measures imaginable, had been a signal to the Muslim republics that their fear was misplaced. Now the Soviet Union was gone, and what remained was a mere shadow, and now that shadow could be erased by a brighter sun to the south. Golovko could see it on his visitor's face. Russia didn't have the power she needed. For all the bluster his country could still summon to awe the West still remembered the Warsaw Pact and the specter of the massive Red Army ready to march to the Bay of Biscay. Other parts of the world knew better. Western Europe and America still remembered the steel fist, which they'd seen but never felt. Those who had felt it knew at once when the grip lessened. More to the point, they knew the significance of the relaxed grip. What will you need? Time and money. Political support to rebuild our military. Help from the West. The general was still staring at the map. It was, he reflected, like being the scion of a powerful capitalist family. The patriarch had died, and he was the heir to a vast fortune, only to discover that it was gone, leaving only debts. He'd come back from America upbeat, feeling that he'd seen the way, seen the future, found a way to secure his country and do it in the proper way, with a professional army composed of long-service experts, held together by esprit de corps, proud guardians and servants of a free nation, the way the Red Army had been on its march to Berlin. But that would take years to build. As it was, if Golovko and the RVS were right, then the best he could hope for was that his nation would rally as it had in 1941, trade space for time as it had in 1941, and struggle back as it had in 1942-43. The general told himself that no one could see the future. That was a gift given to no man. And perhaps that was just as well, because the past, which all men knew, rarely repeated itself. Russia had been lucky against the fascists. One could not depend upon luck. One could depend on a cunning and unpredictable adversary. Other people could look at a map the same as he, see the distances and obstacles, discern the correlation of forces, and know that the wild card lay on another sheet of printed paper, on the other side of the globe. The classical formula was first to cripple the strong, then crush the weak, and then later confront the strong again in one's own good time. Knowing that, Bondarenko could do nothing about it. He was the weak one. He had his own problems. His nation could not count on friends. Only the enemies she had labored so long and so hard to create. Saleh had never known such agony. He'd seen it, and had even inflicted it in his time as part of his country's security service. But not like this, not this bad. It was as though he were now paying for every such episode all at once. His body was racked with pain throughout its entire length. His strength was formidable, his muscles firm, his personal toughness manifest. But not now. Now every gram of his tissue hurt, and when he moved slightly to assuage the hurt, all he accomplished was to move it about to a fractionally different place. The pain was so great as to blot out even the fear which should have attended it. But not for the doctor. Ian McGregor was wearing full surgical garb, a mask over his face, and his hands gloved. Only his concentration prevented them from shaking. He'd just drawn blood with the greatest care of his life, more than he'd ever exercised with AIDS patients, with two male orderlies clamping the patient's arm while he took the samples. He'd never seen a case of hemorrhagic fever. It had been for him nothing more than an entry in a textbook, or an article in The Lancet. Something intellectually interesting, and distantly frightening, as was cancer, as were other African diseases. But this was here and now. "Saleh," the physician asked.
"Yes."
A word, a gasp. "You came here now? I must know if I am to help you." There was no mental hesitation, no consideration of secrets or security. He paused only to take a breath, to summon the energy to answer the question.
"From Baghdad. Airplane," he added unnecessarily.
"Africa. Have you visited Africa recently?"
"Never before."
The head turned left and right, not so much as a centimeter. The eyes screwed shut. The patient was trying to be brave and largely succeeding.
"First time, Africa."
"Have you had sexual relations recently? Last week or so," McGregor clarified. It seemed so cruel a question. One could theoretically get such diseases through sexual contact. Maybe a local prostitute? Perhaps there was another case of this at another local hospital, and it was being hushed up. It took a moment for the man to realize what the man was asking, then another shake.
"No, no women in long time."
McGregor could see it on his face.
"Never again. Not for me."
"Have you had any blood lately? Been given blood, I mean?"
"No."
"Have you been in contact with anyone who had traveled anywhere?"
"No, only Baghdad. Only Baghdad. I am security guard for my general, with him all time, nothing else."
"Thank you. We're going to give you something for the pain. We're going to give you some blood, too, and try to cool you down with ice. I'll be back in a little while."
The patient nodded, and the doctor left the room, carrying the blood-filled tubes in his gloved hands.
"Bloody hell," McGregor breathed.
While the nurses and orderlies did their job, McGregor had his to do. One of the blood samples he split into two, packing both with the greatest care, one for Paris and the Pasteur Institute, and the other for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. They'd go out via Air Express. The rest went to his lead technician, a competent Sudanese, while the doctor drafted a fax. "Possible hemorrhagic fever case," it would read, "giving country, city, and hospital." But first, he lifted his phone and called his contact in the government health department.
"Here?" the government doctor asked. "In Khartoum? Are you sure? Where is the patient from?"
"That is correct," McGregor replied.
"The patient says that he came here from Iraq." "Iraq? Why would this disease come from there? Have you tested for the proper antibodies?" the official demanded.
"The test is being set up right now," the Scot told the African.
"How long?"
"An hour."
"Before you make any notifications, let me come over to see," the official directed.
To supervise, the man meant. McGregor closed his eyes and tightened his grip on the phone. This putative physician was a government appointee, the son of a longtime minister, and the best that could be said for this professional colleague was that while seated in his plush office, he didn't endanger any living patients. McGregor had to struggle to keep his temper in check. It was the same all over Africa. It was as though the local government were desirous to protect their tourist industry, something Sudan singularly lacked, except for some anthropologists doing digs for primitive man down south, near the Ethiopian border. But it was the same everywhere on this lush continent. The government health departments denied everything, one reason why AIDS was so out of control in Central Africa. They'd all denied and denied, and they would keep denying until what percentage of their population were dead? 10, 30, 50? But everyone was afraid to criticize African governments and their bureaucrats. It was so easy to be called a racist, and so better to keep quiet and let people die.
"Doctor," McGregor persisted, "I am confident in my diagnosis, and I have a professional duty to—"
"It can wait until I come over," was the casual reply.
It was just the African way, McGregor knew, and there was no sense in fighting it. This battle he could not win. The Sudanese health department could have his visa lifted in minutes, and then who would treat his patients?
"Very well, doctor. Please come over directly," he urged.
"I have a few things I must do, and then I will come over."
That could mean all day, or even longer, and both men knew it.
The patient is isolated?
Full precautions are in place, MacGregor assured him.
You are a fine physician, Ian, and I know I can trust you to see to it that nothing serious will happen.
The line clicked off. He'd scarcely replaced the phone receiver when the instrument rang again.
Yes?
Doctor, please come to 24, a nurse's voice told him.
He was there in 3 minutes. It was Sohaila. An orderly was carrying out the emesis tray. There was blood in it. She also had come here from Iraq, MacGregor knew. Oh, my God.
None of you have anything to fear.
The words were somewhat reassuring, though not as much as the members of the Revolutionary Council would have liked. The Iranian mullahs were probably telling the truth, but the colonels and generals around the table had fought against Iran as captains and majors, and one never forgets battlefield enemies.
"We need you to take control of your country's military," the senior one went on. "As a result of your cooperation, you will retain your positions. We require only that you swear your loyalty to your new government in God's name."
There would be more to it than that. They'd be watched closely. The officers all knew that. If they put a single foot wrong, they'd be shot for it. But they had nothing in the way of options, except perhaps to be taken out and shot this afternoon. Summary execution was not exactly unknown in either Iran or Iraq, an efficient way of dealing with dissidents, real or imagined, in both countries. Facing such a thing was so different from one side to the other. On the side of the guns, one saw it as a quick, efficient, and final way of settling things in one's favor. From the other side, it had the abrupt injustice of a helicopter crash, just enough time for your spirit to scream, "No!" before the racing earth blotted everything out, the disbelief and outrage of it. Except that in this case they actually had a choice of sorts, certain death now, or the chance of death later. The senior surviving officers of the Iraqi military shared furtive looks. They were not in control of their country's military. The military, the soldiers, were with the people, or with their company officers. The former was pleased to have a surplus of food to eat for the first time in almost a full decade. The latter was pleased as well to see a new day for their country. The break from the old regime was complete. It was just a bad memory now, and there was no return to it. The men in this room could re-establish control only through the good offices of the former enemies who stood at the end of the table with the serene smiles that went along with winning, that went along with holding the gift of life in their hands like pocket change, easily given and just as easily put away. They offered no choice, really. The titular leader of the council nodded his submission, followed in seconds by all the others, and with the gesture, the identity of their country faded into history. From that point on, it was just a matter of making some telephone calls. The only surprise was that it didn't happen on television. For once, the listening posts at Stormtrack and Palm Bowl were beaten by analysts elsewhere. The TV cameras were in place, as would later be seen, but first there was business to be done, and that was recorded on satellite. The first Iranians across the border were in motorized units, which speeded down the highways under radio silence. But it was daylight, and overhead came two KH-11 satellites, which cross-linked their signals to communications birds, and from there down to the reception points. The nearest to Washington were at Fort Belvoir.
Yes, Ryan said, lifting the phone to his ear.
It's been goodly, Mr. President. It's happening now. Iranian troops are crossing the border without any opposition we can see.
Announcement?
Nothing as yet. It looks like they want to be in control first. Jack checked the clock on the night table. Okay, we'll handle it at the morning brief. There was no sense in ruining his sleep. He had people who would work through the night for him, Ryan told himself. He'd done it often enough himself.
Yes, sir.
Ryan replaced the phone and was able to go back to sleep. It was one presidential skill he was learning to master. Maybe, he thought, as he faded out again, Maybe he'd learn to play golf during a crisis. Wouldn't that be?
Fittingly, it was one of the pederasts. He'd been looking after a fellow criminal, this one was a murderer, and doing a proper job of it, judging by the videotapes, which had accelerated the process. Maori had been careful to tell the medical orderlies to supervise the new caregivers closely. The latter had taken the ordinary precautions, wearing their gloves, washing up carefully, keeping the room clean, mopping up all the fluids. This last task had become increasingly difficult with the advancing disease process in the first group of exposed subjects. Their collective moans came through the sound pickup with enough clarity for him to know what they were going through, especially with the absence of pain medications, a violation of the Muslim rules of mercy which Maudi set aside. The second group of subjects were doing what they'd been told, but they'd not been issued masks, and that was for a reason. The pederast was a young man, perhaps early 20s, and he'd been surprisingly attentive to his charge. Whether out of an appreciation for the murderer's pain, or just to appear to be worthy of mercy himself, it didn't matter. Maudi zoomed the camera in. The man's skin was flushed and dry, his movements slow and achy. The doctor lifted the phone. A minute later, one of the army medics came into the picture. He spoke briefly with the pederast, then poked the thermometer into his ear before leaving the room and lifting a corridor phone. Subject 8 has a temperature of 39.2 and reports fatigue and aches in his extremities. His eyes are red and puffy, the medic reported brusquely. It was to be expected that the medics would not feel the same degree of empathy for any of the test subjects that they'd felt for Sister Jean-Baptiste. Even though the latter had been an infidel, at least she'd been a woman of virtue. That was manifestly not true of the men in the room, and it made things easier for everyone.
Thank you.
So it was true, Maudi told himself. The Mayinga strain was indeed airborne. Now it only remained to be seen if it had fully transmitted itself, that this new victim would die from it. When half of the second group showed symptoms, they would be moved across the hall to a treatment room of their own, and the first group, they were all fatally afflicted with the Ebola, would be medically terminated. The director would be pleased, Maudi knew. The latest step in the experiment had been as successful as those before. It was now increasingly certain that they had a weapon in their hands such as no man had ever wielded. "Isn't that wonderful?" the physician observed to himself. The flight out was always easier on the disposition. Movie star walked through the metal detector, stopped, had the magic wand waved over him, resulting in the usual embarrassment over his gold cross pen, and then he walked to the first-class lounge, without even looking around for the policemen who, if they were about, would stop him here and now. But they weren't, and they didn't. His carry-on bag had a leather-bound clipboard in it, but he wouldn't take that out quite yet. The flight was called in due course, and he walked to the jetway and quickly found his seat in the front of the 747. The flight was only half full, and that made things very convenient. No sooner had the aircraft lifted off than he took out his pad and started recording all the things he'd not wished to commit to paper just yet. As usual, his photographic memory helped, and he worked for 3 solid hours until, over mid-Atlantic, he succumbed to the need for sleep. He suspected, correctly, that he'd need it. Chapter 29. Full Court. It might be his last shot, Keelty knew, again using in his own mind a metaphor denoting firearms. The irony of it never registered. He had more important things to do. The previous evening he had been summoning his remaining press contacts, the reliable ones. Others had, if not exactly backed away, at least maintained a discreet distance in their uncertainty, but for most it wasn't all that hard to get their attention. And his 2-hour midnight meeting had been called on the basis of a few key words and phrases known to excite their professional sensibilities. After that, all he had to do was set the rules. This was all on background, not for attribution, not to be quoted. The reporters agreed, of course.
It's pretty disturbing. The FBI subjected the whole top floor of the State Department to lie detector tests, he told them. It was something they'd heard about but not yet confirmed. This would count as confirmation.
But more disturbingly, look at the policies we're seeing now. Build up defense under this Brattano guy, a guy who's grown up within the military-industrial complex. He says he wants to eliminate all the safeguards within the procurement system, wants to slash congressional oversight.
And George Winston, what does he want to do?
Wreck the tax system, make it more regressive, do away with capital gains entirely.
And why?
To lay the country's whole tax burden on the middle and working classes and give the big shots a free ride, that's why.
I never figured Ryan for a professional, for a competent sort of man to occupy the presidency. But I have to tell you, this is not what I expected. He's a reactionary, a radical conservative. I'm not sure what you'd call him.
Are you sure about the thing at State? The New York Times asked.
Keelty nodded.
Positive. 100%.
You mean you people haven't...
Come on, are you doing your job? He asked tiredly.
In the middle of a Mideast crisis, he has the FBI harassing the most senior people we have, trying to accuse them of stealing a letter that was never there.
And now, Keelty's chief of staff added, seeming to speak out of turn, we have the Washington Post about to run a canonization piece on Ryan.
Wait a minute, the Post reporter said, straightening his back. That's Bob Holtzman, not my doing. I told my AME it wasn't a good idea.
Who's the leak? Keelty asked.
I don't have a clue. Bob never lets that out. You know that.
So, what is Ryan doing at CIA? He wants to triple the Directorate of Operations. The spies. Just what the country needs, right?
What is Ryan doing? Keelty asked rhetorically.
Beefing up defense, rewriting the tax code to benefit the fat cats, and taking CIA back to the days of the Cold War.
We're going back to the 1950s.
Why? Keelty demanded.
Why is he doing all this?
What is he thinking about?
Am I the only one in this city asking questions?
When are you people going to do your job?
He's trying to bully Congress and succeeding, and where is the media? Who's protecting the people out there?
What are you saying, Ed? The Times asked.
The gesture of frustration was done with consummate skill.
I'm standing in my own political grave here. I have nothing to gain by this, but I can't just stand by and do nothing. Even if Ryan has the entire power of our government behind him, I can't just let him and his cronies try to concentrate all of the power of our government in a few hands, increase their own ability to spy on us, load the tax system in such a way as to further enrich people who've never paid their fair share, reward the defense industry. What's next? Trashing the civil rights laws?
He's flying his wife to work every day, and you people haven't even remarked that that's never happened before. This is an imperial presidency like Lyndon Johnson never dreamed of, without a Congress to do anything about it. You know what we have here now?
Keelty gave them a moment.
King Jack the First. Somebody's supposed to care about that. Why is it that you people don't?
What do you know about the Holtzman piece, the Boston Globe wanted to know?
Ryan has a lively history in CIA. He's killed people.
James fucking Bond, Keelty's chief of staff, said on cue. The Post reporter then had to defend his publication's honor.
Holtzman doesn't say that. If you mean the time the terrorists came to...
No, not that. Holtzman's going to write about the Moscow thing. Ryan didn't even set that up.
It was Judge Arthur Moore when he was DCI. Ryan was the front man.
It's bad enough anyway. It interfered with the inner workings of the old Soviet Union, and it never occurred to anyone that maybe that wasn't such a great idea. I mean, what the hell, right, screwing around with the government of a country with 10,000 warheads pointed at us? You know, people, that's called an act of war-like.
And why?
To rescue their head thug from a purge for stepping over the line so that we could crack a spy ring inside CIA. I bet he didn't tell Holtzman that, did he?
I haven't seen the story, the Post reporter admitted. I've only heard a few things.
It was almost worthy of a smile. Keelty's sources inside the paper were better than those of the senior political reporter. Okay, you say Ryan has killed people like James Bond. Support that, he said in a flat voice. 4 years ago, remember the bombs in Colombia? Took out some cartel members? Keelty waited for the nod. That was a CIA operation. Ryan went to Colombia. And that was another act of war, people. That's two that I know about. It was amusing to Keelty that Ryan was so skillfully conniving at his own destruction. The Plan Blue move within CIA was already rippling through the Directorate of Intelligence, many of whose senior people faced either early retirement or the diminution of their bureaucratic empires, and many of those enjoyed walking the corridors of power. It was easy for them to think that they were vital to the security of their country, and, thinking that, they had to do something, didn't they? More than that, Ryan had stepped on a lot of bureaucratic toes at Langley, and now it was payback time. All the better that he was a higher target than ever before, that the sources were, after all, merely talking to the former Vice President of the United States, maybe even the real President, they could say, and not to the media, which was, after all, against the law, as opposed to a legitimate discussion of vital national policy. "How sure of that are you?" the Globe asked. "I have dates. Remember when Admiral James Greer died? He was Ryan's mentor. He probably set up the operation from his deathbed. Ryan didn't attend the funeral. He was in Colombia then." "That's a fact, and you can check it," Keelty insisted. "Probably that's why James Cutter committed suicide." "I thought that was an accident," the Times said. "He was out jogging, and he just happened to step in front of a transit bus." "Look, I'm not saying that Cutter was murdered. I am saying that he was implicated in the illegal operation that Ryan was running, and he didn't want to face the music. That gave Jack Ryan the chance to cover his tracks." "You know," Keelty concluded, "I've underestimated this Ryan fellow. He's as slick an operator as this town has seen since Alan Dulles. Maybe Bill Donovan. But the time for that is past. We don't need a CIA with three times as many spies. We don't need to pile more dollars into defense. We don't need to redraft the tax code to protect the millionaires Ryan hangs out with. For sure, we don't need a president who thinks the 1950s were just great. He's doing things to our country which we cannot allow to happen. I don't know," another gesture of frustration. "Maybe I have to go it all alone on this. I know I risk ruining my reputation for all history standing up like this. But damn it, once I swore an oath to the Constitution of our country. First time," he went on in a quiet, reflective voice, "when I won my first House seat, then into the Senate, and then when Roger asked me to step up and be his vice president. You know, you don't forget that sort of thing. And maybe I'm not the right guy for this, okay? Yes, I've done some pretty awful things. Betrayed my wife, lived in a bottle for so many years. The American people probably deserve somebody better than me to stand up and do what's right. But I'm all there is, and I can't break faith with the people who sent me to this town, no matter what it costs. Ryan is not the President of the United States. He knows that. Why else is he trying to change so many things so fast? Why is he trying to bully the senior people at state into lying? Why is he playing with abortion rights? Why is he playing with the tax code through this plutocrat Winston? He's trying to buy it. He's going to continue to bully Congress until the fat cats try to have him elected king or something. I mean, who represents the people right now?" "I just don't see him that way, Ed," the Globe responded after a few seconds. "His politics are pretty far to the right, but he comes across as sincere as hell." "What's the first rule of politics?" the Times asked with a chuckle. Then he continued, "I tell you, if this stuff about Russia and Colombia is true, whoa, it is the 50s, fucking around with other governments that way. We're not supposed to do that anymore. Sure as hell not at that level." "You never got this from us, and you can't reveal the source at Langley." The chief of staff handed out tape cassettes. "But there are enough verifiable facts here to back up everything we've told you." "It's going to take a couple of days," the San Francisco Examiner said, fingering the cassette and looking at his colleagues. The race started now. Every reporter in the room would want to be the first to break the story. That process would start with them playing their tapes in their cars during the drive to their homes, and the one with the shortest drive had the advantage.
Gentlemen, all I can say is this is an important story, and you have to apply your best professional conduct to it.
It's not for me, Keelty said. I wish I could pick someone else to do this. Someone with a better record. But I can't. Not for me. It's for the country. And that means you have to play it as straight as you can.
We will, Ed, the Times promised.
He checked his watch. Almost 3 in the morning. He'd work all day to make the 10 p.m. deadline. In that time, he'd have to verify, re-verify, and conference in with his assistant managing editor to make sure that he got the front page above the fold. The West Coast papers had the advantage, 3 more hours because of time zones. But he knew how to beat them to the punch. The coffee cups went down on the table, and the journalists rose, tucking their personal mini-tape machines in their jacket pockets, and each holding his personal cassette in the left hand while the right fished for the car keys.
"Talk to me, Ben," Jack commanded barely 4 hours later. "Still nothing on the local TV, but we've caught microwave stuff transmitted for later broadcast."
Goodley paused as Ryan took his seat behind the desk.
"Quality is too poor to show you, but we have the audio tracks. Anyway, they spent all day consolidating power. Tomorrow, they go public. Probably the word's out on the street, and the official stuff will be for the rest of the world."
"Smart," the president observed.
"Agreed," Goodley nodded.
"New wild card. The premier of Turkmenistan bit the big one, supposedly an automobile accident. Golovko called me about just after 5, I think, to let us know. He ain't a real happy camper at the moment. He thinks that Iraq and Turkoland are part of the same play."
"Do we have anything to support that?" Ryan asked, tying his necktie. It was a dumb question.
"You kidding, boss? We don't have crap. Not even overheads in this case."
Jack looked down at his desktop for a second.
"You know, for all the things people say about how powerful CIA is. Hey, I worked there, remember? Thank God for CNN."
"Yeah, I know. Good news, the Russians are telling us at least some of what they know."
"Scared," the president observed.
"Very," the national intelligence officer agreed.
"Okay, we have Iran taking over Iraq. We have a dead leader in Turkmenistan. Analysis?" Jack asked.
"I won't contradict Golovko on this one. He doubtless does have agents in place, and it sounds like he's in the same situation we're in. He can watch and worry, but he doesn't have any real operational possibilities. Maybe it's a coincidence, but spooks aren't supposed to believe in such things. Damn sure Sergei doesn't. He thinks it's all one play. I think that's a definite possibility."
"I'll be talking to Vasco about that, too. What he says is shaping up is starting to look a little scary. We'll be hearing from the Saudis today."
And Israel could not be far behind, Ryan knew.
"China?" the president asked next.
"Maybe the other side of the world was a little better."
It wasn't.
"Major exercise. Surface and subsurface combatants. No air yet, but the overheads show the fighter bases are tooling up."
"Wait a minute."
"Yes, sir. If it's a planned exercise, why weren't they ready for it?"
"I'll be talking to the Pentagon about that one at 8:30. The ambassador had a little talk with the foreign ministry type. Feedback is, no big deal. The ministry didn't even know about it. Routine training."
"Bullshit."
"Maybe. Taiwan is still low-keying it, but they'll be sending some ships out today. Well, tonight over there. We have assets heading to the area. The Taiwanese are playing ball, full cooperation with our observers in their listening posts. Soon they will ask us what we will do if A or B happens. We need to think about that. The Pentagon says that the PRC doesn't have the assets to launch an invasion, same as back in 96. The ROC Air Force is stronger now than it was, so I don't see that this is likely to lead anywhere. Maybe it really is just an exercise. Maybe they want to see how we, you that is, will react."
"What's Adler think?"
"He says to ignore it. I think he's right. Taiwan is playing low-key. I think we do the same. We move ships, especially subs, but we keep them out of sight. SyncPak seems to have a handle on it. We let him run it for the time being. Ryan nodded.
Through SecDef, yes.
Europe?
Nice and quiet. Ditto our hemisphere. Ditto Africa. You know, if the Chinese are just being their usual obnoxious selves, then the only real problem is the Persian Gulf. And the truth of the matter is that we've been there and done that, sir. We've told the Saudis that we're not going to back off of them.
That word will get to the other side in due course, and it ought to make the other side stop and think before making any plans to go farther. I don't like the UIR thing, but I think we can deal with it. Iran is fundamentally unstable. The people in that country want more freedom. And when they get a taste, that country will change. We can ride it out.
Ryan smiled and poured himself a cup of decaf.
You're getting very confident, Dr. Goodley.
You pay me to think. I might as well tell you what's moving around between the ears, boss.
Okay, get on with your work and keep me posted. I have to figure a way to reconstitute the Supreme Court today.
Ryan sipped his coffee and waited for Ernie to come in.
This job wasn't all that tough, was it?
Not when you had a good team working for you.
It's about seduction, Clark said to the shiny new faces in the auditorium, catching Ding's grin in the back of the room and cringing. The training film they'd just watched had gone over the history of six important cases. There were only five prints of the film, and this one was already being rewound for the walk back to the vault. Two of the cases he'd worked himself. One of the agents had been executed in the basement of 2 Dzerzhinsky Square after being burned by a KGB mole inside Langley. The other had a small farm in the birch country of northern New Hampshire, probably still wishing that he could go home. But Russia was still Russia, and the narrow view their culture took of high treason wasn't an invention of the previous regime. Such people were forever orphans. Clark turned the page and continued from his notes. You will seek out people with problems. You will sympathize with those problems. The people with whom you will work are not perfect. They will all have beefs. Some of them will come to you. You don't have to love them, but you do have to be loyal to them. What do I mean by seduction? Everyone in this room has done it once or twice, right? You listen more than you talk. You nod. You agree. Sure, you're smarter than your boss. I know about him. We have the same sort of jerk in our government. I had a boss like that once myself. It's hard to be an honest man in that kind of government, isn't it? You bet. Honor really is important. When they say that, you know they want money. That's fine, Clark told them. They never expect as much as they ask for. We have the budget to pay anything they want, but the important thing is getting them on the hook. Once they lose their virginity, people, they can't get it back. Your agents, the people you recruit, will get addicted to what they do. It's fun to be a spy. Even the most ideologically pure people you recruit will giggle from time to time because they know something nobody else knows. They will all have something wrong with them. The most idealistic ones are often the worst. They experience guilt. They drink. Some might go to their priest, even. I've had that happen to me. Some break the rules for the first time and figure no rules matter anymore. Those kind will start boffing every girl that crosses their path and taking all sorts of chances. Handling agents is an art. You are mother, father, priest, and teacher to them. You have to settle them down. You have to tell them to look after their families and look after their own ass, especially the good ideological recruits. They're dependable for a lot of things, but one of them is to get too much into it. A lot of these agents self-destruct. They can turn into crusaders. Few of the crusaders, Clark went on, died of old age. The agent who wants money is often the most reliable. They don't take too many chances. They want out eventually, so they can live the good life in Hollywood and get laid by a starlet or something. Nice thing about agents who work for money. They want to live to spend it. On the other hand, when you need something done in a hurry, when you need somebody to take a risk, you can use a money guy, just be ready to evac him the next day. Sooner or later, he'll figure that he's done enough and demand to be got out. What am I telling you? There are no hard and fast rules in this business. You have to use your heads. You have to know about people, how they are, how they act, how they think. You must have genuine empathy with your agents, whether you like them or not. Most you will not like, he promised them. You saw the film. Every word was real. Three of those cases ended with a dead agent. One ended with a dead officer. Remember that. Okay, you now have a break. Mr. Revelle will have you in the next class. Clark assembled his notes and walked to the back of the room while the trainees absorbed the lessons in silence.
"Gee, Mr. C., does that mean seduction is okay?" Ding asked.
"Only when you get paid for it, Domingo." All of Group 2 was sick now. It was as though they'd all punched in on some sort of time clock. Within 10 hours, they'd all complained of fever and aches, flu symptoms. Some knew, Modi saw, or certainly suspected what had happened to them. Some of them continued to help the sicker subjects to whom they were assigned. Others called for the army medics to complain, or just sat on the floor in the treatment room and did nothing but savor their own illness in fear that they would become what they saw. Again, the conditions of their prior imprisonment and diet worked against them. The hungry and debilitated are more easily controlled than the healthy and well-fed. The original group was deteriorating at the expected rate. Their pain grew worse, to the point that their slow writhing lessened, because it hurt more to move than to remain still. One seemed very close to death, and Moody wondered if, as with Benedict Macusa, this victim's heart was unusually vulnerable to the Ebola Mayinga strain. Perhaps this subtype of the disease had a previously unsuspected affinity for heart tissue. That would have been interesting to learn in the abstract, but he'd gone well beyond the abstract study of the disease. "We gain nothing by continuing this phase, Moody," the director observed, standing beside the younger man and watching the TV monitors. "Next step." "As you wish." Dr. Moody lifted the phone and spoke for a minute or so. It took 15 minutes to get things moving, and then the medical orderlies entered the picture, taking all of the 9 members of the second group out of that room, then across the corridor to a second large treatment room, where, on a different set of monitors, the physicians saw that each was assigned a bed and given a medication which, in but a few minutes, had them all asleep. The medics then returned to the original group. Half of them were asleep anyway, and all the others stuporous, unable to resist. The wakeful ones were killed first with injections of Dilaudid, a powerful synthetic narcotic, into whatever vein was the most convenient. The executions took but a few minutes and were, in the end, merciful. The bodies were loaded one by one onto gurneys for transport to the incinerator. Next, the mattresses and bedclothes were bundled for burning, leaving only the metal frames of the beds. These, along with the rest of the room, were sprayed with caustic chemicals. The room would be sealed for several days, then sprayed again, and the collective attention of the facility staff would transfer to Group 2, 9 condemned criminals who had proven, or so it would seem, that Ebola Zaire Mayinga could be transmitted through the air. The health department official took a whole day to arrive, doubtless delayed, Dr. McGregor suspected, by a pile of paperwork on his desk, a fine dinner, and a night with whatever woman spiced up his daily life. And probably the paperwork was still there on his desk, the Scot told himself. At least he knew about the proper precautions. The government doctor barely entered the room at all. He had to come an additional reluctant step so that the door could be closed behind him, but moved no farther than that, standing there, his head tilting and his eyes squinting, the better to observe the patient from 2 meters away. The lights in the room were turned down so as not to hurt Saleh's eyes. Despite that, the discoloration of his skin was obvious. The 2 hanging units of type O blood and the morphine drip told the rest, along with the chart, which the government official held in his gloved, trembling hands.
"The antibody tests?" he asked quietly.
summoning his official dignity. Positive, MacGregor told him. The first documented Ebola outbreak, no one knew how far back the disease went, how many jungle villages it might have exterminated 100 years earlier, for example, had gone through the nearest hospital staff with frightening speed, to the point that the medical personnel had left the facility in panic. And that, perversely, had helped end the outbreak more rapidly than continued treatment might have done. The victims died, and nobody got close enough to them to catch what they had. African medics now knew what precautions to take. Everyone was masked and gloved, and disinfection procedures were ruthlessly enforced. As casual and careless as many African personnel often were, this was one lesson they'd taken to heart. And with that feeling of safety established, they, like medical personnel all over the world, did the best they could. For this patient, that was very little use. The chart showed that, too.
"From Iraq?" the official asked.
Dr. MacGregor nodded.
"That is what he told me.
I must check on that with the proper authorities."
"Doctor, I have a report to make," MacGregor insisted. "This is a possible outbreak and—"
"No."
The official shook his head.
"Not until we know more. When we make a report, if we do, we must forward all of the necessary information for the alert to be useful."
"But—"
"But this is my responsibility, and it is my duty to see that the responsibility is properly executed."
He pointed the chart to the patient. His hand wasn't shaking now that he had established his power over the case.
"Does he have a family? Who can tell us more about him?"
"I don't know."
"Let me check that out," the government doctor said. "Have your people make copies of all records and send them to me at once."
With a stern order given, the health department representative felt as though he had done his duty to his profession and his country. MacGregor nodded his submission. Moments like this made him hate Africa. His country had been here for more than a century. A fellow Scot named Gordon had come to the Sudan, fallen in love with it. Was the man mad, MacGregor wondered, and died right in this city 120 years earlier. Then the Sudan had become a British protectorate. A regiment of infantry had been raised from this country, and that regiment had fought bravely and well under British officers. But then Sudan had been returned to the Sudanese, too quickly, without the time and money spent to create the institutional infrastructure to turn a tribal wasteland into a viable nation. The same story had been told in the same way all over the continent, and people of Africa were still paying the price for that disservice. It was one more thing neither he nor any other European could speak aloud except with one another, and sometimes not even then, for fear of being called a racist. But if he were a racist, then why had he come here?
"You will have them in 2 hours."
"Very well."
The official walked out the door. There the head nurse for the unit would take him to the disinfection area, and for that the official would follow orders like a child under the eye of a stern mother. Pat Martin came in with a well-stuffed briefcase, from which he took 14 folders, laddering them across the coffee table in alphabetical order. Actually, they were labeled A to M, because President Ryan had specifically asked that he not know the names at first.
"You know, I'd feel a lot better if you hadn't given me all this power," Martin said without looking up.
"Why's that?" Jack asked.
"I'm just a prosecutor, Mr. President. A pretty good one, sure, and now I run the criminal division, and that's nice, too, but I'm only—"
"How do you think I feel?" Ryan demanded,
then softened his voice.
"Nobody since Washington has been stuck with this job, and what makes you think I know what I'm supposed to be doing? Hell, I'm not even a lawyer to understand all this stuff without a crib sheet."
Martin looked up with half a smile.
"Okay, I deserved that."
But Ryan had set the criteria. Before him was a roster of the senior federal judiciary. Each of the 14 folders gave the professional history of a judge in the United States Court of Appeals, ranging from one in Boston to another in Seattle.
The president had ordered Martin and his people to select judges of no less than 10 years' experience, with no less than 50 important written decisions, as distinguished from routine matters like which side won in a liability case, none of which had been overturned by the Supreme Court, or if one or two had been overturned, had been vindicated by a later reversal in Washington.
"This is a good bunch," Martin said.
"Death penalty?"
"The Constitution specifically provides for that, remember? Fifth Amendment," Martin quoted from memory. "Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property, without due process of law. So, with due process, you can take a person's life, but you can only try him once for it. The court established the criteria for that in a number of cases in the 70s and 80s. Guilt trial followed by penalty trial, with the penalty phase dependent upon special circumstances. All of these judges have upheld that rule, with a few exceptions. D here struck down a Mississippi case on the basis of mental incompetence. That was a good call, even though the crime was pretty gruesome. The Supreme Court affirmed it without comment or hearing. Sir, the problem with the system is one that nobody can really fix. It's just the nature of law. A lot of legal principles are based on decisions from unusual cases. There's a dictum that hard cases make for bad law, like that case in England, remember? Two little kids murder a younger kid. What the hell is a judge supposed to do when the defendants are 8 years old, definitely guilty of a brutal murder, but only 8 years old? What you do then is, you pray some other judge gets stuck with it. Somehow we all try to make cohesive legal doctrine out of that. It's not really possible, but we do it anyway.
I figure you picked tough ones, Pat.
Did you pick fair ones? The president asked.
Remember what I said a minute ago? I don't want this sort of power. I didn't dare do otherwise. E here reversed a conviction one of my best people got on a technicality, an issue of admissibility. And when he did it, we were all pretty mad. The issue was entrapment, where the line is. The defendant was guilty as hell, no doubt of it. But Judge E looked at the arguments and probably made the right call. And that ruling is part of FBI guidelines now. Jack looked at the folders. It would be a full week's reading. This, as Arnie had told him a few days before, would be his most important act as president. No chief executive since Washington had been faced with the necessity of appointing the entire Supreme Court. And even that had been in an age when the national consensus on law had been far firmer and deeper than what existed in America now. Back then, cruel and unusual punishment had meant the rack and burning at the stake, both of those things that had been used in pre-revolutionary America, but in more recent rulings had been taken to mean the absence of cable television and denial of sex change operations, or just overcrowding in the prisons. So fine, Ryan thought, the prisons are too crowded. And then why not release dangerous criminals on society for fear of being cruel to convicted felons? Now he had the power to change that. All he had to do was select judges who took as harsh a view on crime as he did. An outlook he'd learned from listening to his father's occasional rant about a particularly vile crime, or an especially bat-brained judge who hadn't ever viewed a crime scene, and therefore never really known what the issues were. And for Ryan, there was the personal element. He'd been the subject of attempted murder, as had his wife and children. He knew what it was all about, the outrage at facing the fact that there were people who could take a life as easily as buying candy at a drugstore, who preyed on others as though they were game animals, and whose actions cried out for retribution. He could remember looking into Sean Miller's eyes more than once and seeing nothing, nothing in there at all. No humanity, no empathy, no feelings, not even hatred. So outside the human community he'd taken himself that there was no returning. And yet, Ryan closed his eyes, remembering the moment,
a loaded Browning pistol in his grip, his blood boiling in his veins, but his hands like ice. The ex